It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Coming up, airstrikes against the Islamic State militants. We'll also have the latest on events in Burkina Faso. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Pentagon says U.S. airstrikes hit Islamic State targets in Syria who were plotting to attack the United States or Europe. U.S. Central Command says 5 Khorasan Group targets were struck Wednesday night near the Sarmada, close to the Turkish border. The jet struck terrorists, destroyed vehicles, buildings, and bomb-making facilities. Pentagon says it took decisive action to protect U.S. interest and to remove terrorist capability to act. President Obama will meet later today with congressional leaders about their legislative plans and says one measure for which he wants a specific authorization are those airstrikes against the militants in Iraq and Syria. Mr. Obama says the U.S. military force needs both White House and congressional support.
The world needs to know we are united behind this effort, and the men and women of our military deserve our clear and unified support.
Coalition airstrikes take place daily in Syria and Iraq. Burkina Faso's army-appointed leader has rejected a demand from the African Union that he return power to a civilian government within 2 weeks or risk sanctions. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zeta said Thursday a council of elders will select what he called an eminent civilian personality to lead the transition government before elections next November. However, he said the process will not be rushed either by international pressure or the growing unrest with Burkina Faso within the country since the military seized power on Friday after President Blaise Compaoré resigned and fled the country. This is VOA News. Thousands of workers took to the streets of Brussels on Thursday protesting the Belgian government's free market reforms and austerity measures. At least 14 people were injured when protesters clashed with police. Protesters pelted police with stones and fireworks, overturning cars or setting them on fire. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators. Workers were protesting plans by the country's new center-right government to increase the pension age from 65 to 67. They also want to freeze wages and cut public services. European stock markets surged Thursday after the European Central Bank indicated it's considering further action to boost the sluggish economy of the euro currency zone. Lisa Bryant is in Paris with our report.
As expected, the European Central Bank left its main interest rate unchanged. It's already at a record low of only 0.05%. At a news conference Thursday afternoon, ECB chief Mario Draghi said the central bank wanted to first see the effects of measures already put into place to counter the risk of deflation and boost European economies. But Mr. Draghi also said the ECB was preparing for more action if needed.
Should it become necessary to further address risks of too prolonged a period of low inflation, the Governing Council is unanimous in its commitment to using additional unconventional instruments within its mandate.
The outlook is already pretty grim for the 18 nations using the euro currency. Governments have been slashing spending and raising taxes to overcome a years-long debt crisis. Overall, eurozone unemployment is an alarming 11.5%, and both businesses and consumers have been tightening their belts, sparking fears the eurozone will fall into a downward price spiral known as deflation. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Locked in a bitter standoff with the West over the ongoing pro-Russian rebellion in Ukraine, Moscow says it will boycott an upcoming international nuclear security summit hosted by the United States. 2016 summit was designed with the aim of locking down nuclear material across the globe. United States, the European Union, and Ukraine accuse Moscow of supplying pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine with military hardware, training, and other forms of support. Washington and Brussels have responded with a series of economic and travel sanctions aimed at punishing the Russians for their involvement in eastern Ukraine. Moscow has denied any direct role in the deadly six-month uprising. You can get more news at our website, voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, November 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Another round of talks to end South Sudan's nearly 11-month-old conflict have begun in Addis Ababa.
The government does want to share power, actually, with the rebel, provided that it doesn't undermine the constitutional setting.
Atene Wek Atene is spokesman for President Salva Kiir of South Sudan. It seems there's no end in sight for political bickering in Somalia. Zambia's government has again warned citizens to desist from political activities until President Michael Sata is laid to rest. And the Danish government sets conditions for re-engaging with Zimbabwe.
Debt relief is not easy, and it will require reforms in different areas and also further land reform, including compensation, as also enshrined in the constitution.
Morgan Jensen is the Danish Trade and Cooperation Development Minister. The director of the UN World Food Program addresses food security in Ebola-affected West African countries, and a praise singer is helping to spread the word about Ebola in Mali. Those stories plus Mark Omar Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. East African leaders of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD, have again warned South Sudan's warring parties to end their country's almost 11-month-old civil war. The meeting in Addis Ababa of six IGAD leaders, as well as President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar, follows fresh UN Security Council warnings this week of possible sanctions to stem the violence that has left thousands dead and forced almost 2 million from their homes. Wakit Simon Wudu of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has details from Juba.
Mr. Kiir's spokesman, Atene Wek Atene, says it is hoped that sticking points that have been blocking peace in South Sudan will be resolved at the summit in Addis Ababa. Atene says that key issues that need to be sorted out are
the nature of transitional government and how the powers could be shared between the president and the prime minister. You know, the government does want to share power, actually, with the rebel, provided that it doesn't undermine the constitutional setting.
Early last month, IGAD adjourned the talks in Addis Ababa after the two main parties to South Sudan's conflict, the government and Machar's opposition group, failed to agree on what powers should be given to a prime minister of South Sudan, a new position that could be part of a transitional government. The two parties are expected to make progress at this latest round of talks on other major issues too, including reforms to the transitional constitution and to security. Atene says security reforms continue to be a big sticking point at the talks. He blames that on the rebels' insistence that
the rebels are actually footing a very draconian demand by saying that their leader should remain as a commander-in-chief of the forces, which are actually supposed to be absorbed according to the government. Some of them, they wanted to maintain the army for 30 months. If you allow them to have an army in that 30 months, then it is like, you know, you just postpone the problem of today for tomorrow.
Mr. Kiir is also expected to hold face-to-face talks in Addis with the Machar, Atene says. The two leaders have only met a handful of times since fighting erupted in Juba last December. The first IGAD-led talks to end the conflict in South Sudan were held in January 10 months ago. At the end of those talks, the warring sides signed a cessation of hostilities agreement, but it was violated within a few hours. In the fighting that followed, more than 10,000 people have died and around 1.8 million people have been displaced. Aid agencies are warning that the country is teetering on the edge of famine unless peace is restored. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudo from Juba.
The Danish government says Zimbabwe should first address human rights issues in the country and compensate commercial farmers who were disposed of their land during the controversial land reform program, which began in 2000 as conditions for re-engagement. European Union member countries have recently and individually started to rebuild their relations with Harare. But visiting Danish Trade and Cooperation Development Minister Morgan Jensen says his country will only re-engage after Zimbabwe takes steps to address these concerns. Erwin Chifera reports from Harare.
Speaking to journalists after meeting ministers Patrick Chinamasa and Joseph Made of Finance and Agriculture respectively and Reserve Bank Governor John Manguja, Jansen, who is on a three-day visit to Harare, said Denmark strongly believes in human rights, adding this forms the basis of their support to developing countries, including Zimbabwe. He said while Zimbabwe's economy is in bad shape, it has a potential to develop if necessary reforms are implemented. The reforms, he said, include debt resolution, the compensation of white farmers who lost their land under the controversial land reform program, and clarification of the country's indigenization law.
Debt relief is not easy, and it will require reforms in different areas. And also further land reform, including compensation, as also enshrined in the constitution, is important for reinforcing, I think, the agricultural sector, which is and I think we agree on that, the backbone of the economy.
Chinamasa assured Jansen Zimbabwe would clarify the indigenization law, adding the government is ready to compensate the white farmers, but would do so once resources became available.
Under our constitution, we have an obligation to compensate white farmers. If there is any failure at the moment, it's the same failure that we have to service our debt. It's not out of an intention not to compensate, but out of lack of resources to compensate.
He said following the lifting up of sanctions by the European Union and the re-engagement talks, he expected the Danish government to channel all development support through the government to ensure transparency. Jansen said his government was ready to support Zimbabwe in a number of areas, including agriculture and energy.
Denmark will proceed with our cooperation with Zimbabwe over the coming years in three areas: when it comes to good governance, justice and accountability, when it comes to infrastructure rehabilitation, and also when it comes to developing of the agricultural sector.
Denmark is currently supporting the Judicial Service Commission in the construction of 30 courthouses across the country. The indigenization law requires foreign-owned companies with assets of more than $500,000 to cede or sell a 51% stake to black locals. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
8 African heads of state and government have so far confirmed that they will attend the funeral ceremonies of the late Zambian President Michael Sata, which is scheduled to be held November 11th. Information Minister Joseph Katema tells reporter Peter Clotty that preparations for the late president's funeral are proceeding smoothly, despite reports of tension within the rank and file of the governing Patriotic Front Party.
The program is going on well. Right now, people have been accorded the chance to pay their last respect to the former head of state, the late president. And they are coming in numbers. It's only that by 18 hours, that is the 6 p.m., the procession closes. And you can see the anguish and the disappointment of people being turned back. Those would not manage to beat the time. The queues are long. As you know, he was a loved leader, loved by the grassroots.
But Mr. Katema, some people are expressing concern that there appear to be still wrangling in the ruling party, which they say is taking the shine away of the respect people are paying to the deceased president, and they have condemned it. What is the government position on this?
The government position is that we have discouraged, or in fact, we have suspended all activities, political activities of any nature in the country until after the burial of late president. That is when probably people can start participating in the political processes. That is a guarantee that people will continue mourning peacefully as they are doing right now.
The interim president removed General Secretary Mr. Lungu from the party's head, now restored him. What is the situation here? There appears to be confusion in here.
The Secretary General has been reinstated. That was a decision which was made by the Central Committee of the ruling party in the same spirit that you have talked about. That is the same thing that I have said here, that it is best not to make any political pronouncements at the moment in time until we bury our president. We should desist from making pronouncements which could be provocative, which can be interpreted as being contrary to the spirit or the aspirations of their beloved president.
Joseph Katema, Zambia's information minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 7th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Somalia's political leaders are at loggerheads once again over the reorganization of the cabinet, prompting a warning from the United Nations to focus on building credible institutions to move the country forward. Analysts say the next year will be crucial for solidifying Somalia's recent gains after decades of lawlessness. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
The controversial began Monday when UN envoy to Somalia Nicholas Kay said he was concerned about allegations that lawmakers were being bribed in exchange for votes to ouster the prime minister. In a statement, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud acknowledged the UN's concern, but called for the international community to respect Somalia's right to determine its own future and allow Somali leaders to solve their differences. The political bickering between the president and Prime Minister Abdiwali Sheikh Ahmed began 2 weeks ago after the premier made a cabinet reshuffle. Among those affected was the president's close ally and minister of livestock and husbandry, Farah Sheikh Abdul Qadir. The president termed the changes null and void, setting off an increasingly public dispute between the two leaders and their supporters in the parliament. This is the kind of division that has plagued Somali politics for years. But Somali lawmaker and former constitution minister Abdirahman Hosh says it is good for Somali leaders to wrangle, calling it part of a democratic process. He adds ultimately the politicians must settle their disputes. Top leaders' political wrangling is a good thing for us. Leaders who agree on everything is not good for the country. The politics itself is about people with different views coming together. But when there is division, then a solution has to be found to solve the differences. Some political observers have blamed the Somali constitution for continuous infighting between presidents and prime ministers. James Smith is an independent analyst who tells VOA that clashes between the two leaders are almost a certainty.
This speaks of a broader problem with the constitutional sort of makeup of the executive. But at the same time, it's the lines between these two individuals, the responsibilities and authorities of these two individuals, is so blurred that actually, you know, infighting is almost to be expected.
The current Somali government marked its second year in power a month ago, a very long term of political stability by Somali standards. Smith notes whichever way this latest infighting ends, the government is running out of time to build credible institutions and prepare for elections in 2016.
I'm quietly optimistic that this will be resolved without a collapse of the cabinet, without a replacement of the prime minister. I think there's an awareness that patience is running out amongst the international circles, despite some of the rhetoric that's been coming out against them recently.
Hosh agrees the government has many other problems on its plate and cannot afford to lose more time to internal politics. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The executive director of the UN World Food Programme, Etherine Cousin, just returned from a three-day trip to Sierra Leone, where she met with key officials to discuss the fight against Ebola. According to Cousin, WFP has already provided food assistance to 1.3 million people in the Ebola-affected countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. She tells Ricky Shryak there is more work to be done if they are going to stop the outbreak, while also addressing the food security of the people.
In August, the plan was we would reach 1 million people. We recognize that we're going to feed a lot more than 1 million, significantly more than 1 million people as we move forward. And what we are doing is we are increasing the number as required. We are not limiting to a particular number. Our goal is to feed as many people as required to ensure that those who are affected by this disease do not go without the food that is required. In the past, we were, as humanitarians, were limited in what we could do based upon the money that we received. What we know is that people can't wait. And so we've loaned money, we've advanced money to this operation from our treasury in the organization to support the escalation and the scale up of our activities.
Besides food, were you getting a sense that people needed more cars and transportation vehicles for the sick patients, and is WFP involved in providing anything such as transportation? Because I saw quite a few people who were actually waiting hours and hours to get transported places, and I don't know if there was a lack of ambulance vehicles and if WFP was helping out on that scale.
We have helped out the government and WHO and the other entities that are working to provide transportation. We don't provide transportation, but we have been the procurers of cars. And even yesterday when I was talking to DFID, they had procured, and now we're storing for them and we'll distribute, motorcycles that can be used for pickups of, not patients, but it can be used to transport people to the different rural areas where the roads are more challenging. And we're also now going to begin to procure food locally as well to ensure that those, particularly smallholder farmers who have been impacted by the closure of markets and quarantine areas, that we can assist them by purchasing their food for distribution in our program. So we'll have a mixture of food that we bring in, that we procure internationally, as well as food that we procure locally.
There were some farmers I saw in Sierra Leone who said that they weren't able to harvest their crops because they were in quarantine areas. It was illegal for them to have the laborers who usually sleep in their home. Yeah. So did you guys see a big impact?
We haven't seen it yet, but we're in the process with FAO of doing an assessment of the agricultural system and the impact that Ebola is having on the agricultural system. We should have more information on that within the coming weeks.
That was Ethelyn Cousin, Executive Director of the UN World Food Programme. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Social structures already in place have proven helpful to fight Ebola in West Africa. In Mali, griot or praise singers, important in their role as advisors and communicators, as well as local healers and religious leaders, have been spreading awareness since the country reported its first Ebola case. 12 days into the incubation period for 79 hospital workers and family members in the town of Kaye, no new cases have been reported. Katerina Hoyer has more for VOA.
In Kaye, Ebola monitoring continues and life is returning to normal 2 weeks after a toddler died of Ebola after traveling with her grandmother from Guinea. But one man, Guyo Ibrahim Sako, is keeping the message of precautions against the deadly virus alive by crisscrossing the town on his motorbike with a sound system mounted on top, telling people to wash their hands. I saw what happened in Mali's neighboring countries, in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and it scared me. When I heard that the disease had arrived in Kai, I acted immediately, he says. Sako began his rides the day after it was reported the baby girl had tested positive for Ebola. He says he felt compelled to do something. Mali is a poor country. We lack the means to deal with Ebola. However, by changing people's mindset and behavior, we can limit the problem, he says. While authorities' initial response may have been swift, the willingness to spread awareness and help build the capacity to receive more suspected Ebola cases and patients have been slow and hampered by bureaucracy. 2 weeks after Mali's first Ebola case was reported in Kai, humanitarian organizations have taken over the response, setting up a treatment center as well as training medical staff and volunteers to monitor the 79 people in isolation here. Tracing of possible contacts and new cases is limited to radio spots asking people to report to the hospital or their local health clinic. 12 days have passed since family members and hospital staff were quarantined, either in their homes or at the Fuseni Dao Hospital. The time period is the most likely phase when those potentially infected would have begun to show symptoms of the disease. If no new cases are reported in the next 10 days, Mali's first encounter with Ebola might be limited to one single case. I believe our team did the best job they could with the limited resources we had at the time, says Tuane Konare, the general director at the Kai Hospital. It's true, we couldn't have done it without help from our international partners. We must also remember it's not over yet. We're still waiting for the 21 days, the time when people in isolation should be symptom-free, to pass, the doctor continues. Katrina Höje for VOA News, Kai.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. A Nigeria Super Eagles outfit composed of home-based players host Ghana's under-23 side, the Black Meteors, in a friendly to mark the commissioning of the newly constructed Akwa Ibom International Stadium in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State, South Nigeria, today, Friday. According to media reports in Lagos, three heads of state, President John Mahama of Ghana, Ivory Coast's Alassane Ouattara, and Nigeria's Goodluck Jonathan, are expected to grace the match at this 30,000-seater stadium. The event will also be used to test-run preparations for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier between African champions Nigeria Super Eagles and the rapidly improving South African Bafana Bafana. Meanwhile, the Uganda Cranes host the Walia Antelopes of Ethiopia in a build-up match in Kampala, Uganda, on Sunday. Both Ethiopia and Uganda are gearing up for the Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers next week. Uganda's Ministry of Sports will use the event to highlight their campaign against the scourge of HIV and AIDS. Turning to athletics, Kenya's former world marathon record holder Wilson Kipsang has vowed to set a new world record next year. Kipsang told the Nairobi media on return from his triumph at the New York City Marathon that he has his sights focused on setting the world record at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China next year. Kipsang's world record of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 23 seconds was erased by his compatriot Dennis Kipruto Kimeto at the Berlin Marathon in Germany in September. Kimeto's record stands at 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds. Finally, in golf, the East Africa Community Golf Shield contest tees off in Entebbe, Uganda, today, Friday. Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, and hosts Uganda compete at the Entebbe Golf Club, which will be marking their 113th year of existence. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burkina Faso's army appointed leader has rejected a demand from the African Union that he return power to a civilian-led government within 2 weeks or risk sanctions. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida said Thursday a council of elders will select what he called an eminent civilian personality to lead the transition government before elections next November. However, he said the process will not be rushed, either by international pressure or the growing unrest within Burkina Faso since the military seized power on Friday. Libya's Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that the country's internationally recognized parliament is invalid, adding to an already tumultuous political scene in the deeply fractured North African state. And that's it for this Friday, November 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stradak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Music Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy. and mind massage. Join me, I'm Heather Maxwell, for Music Time in Africa, every Saturday and Sunday at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC.